This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to the DGP with province writer Dana G.
Hi, welcome to the DGP. I'm Dana G. This week on the episode, I talked to two fantastic Canadian writers. Elizabeth Hay is the award-winning Giller Prize winning, actually, novelist. She's back on the scene with her new novel, His Whole Life. I've read it. It's great. It's page turner. Also, TV creator, writer, and director Chris Haddock. That name might ring a bell if you've watched Canadian television in the last two or so decades. He's the guy behind Da Vinci's Inquest. Now, we're going to start with Haddock today. We're going to start by visiting him on set for his new show, The Romeo Section. You'll be able to hear the noise in the background because we're actually sitting in the craft services tent while I'm interviewing him. So you've got crew coming in and out having their lunch break. The thing about Haddock is it's always a great conversation. You get to sit down with him, and he's got this real sense of Vancouver and the sort of the dark side of our city. You know, he's the guy who gave us the great crusading coroner, Dominic Da Vinci. Then he took Da Vinci off the streets and put him in City Hall, where he campaigned for all sorts of things that are actually, you know, come up in the city all the time. And then he did intelligence. He took a bit of a break and went and worked down south and did some writing for Boardwalk Empire, the big HBO show. But now he's back. Yeah, he's back in Canada. He's back on the CBC Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock with the new espionage, spy, surveillance drama called The Romeo Section. So here's a chance to hear Chris in his natural environment, which is on the set of a TV show. All right, Chris, thanks for joining us on the DGP today. Here we are at your circus, yes. I guess.
And it is.
your circus master at the shooting the Romeo section.
Correct.
So for people listening, Dave, what's the Romeo section?
The Romeo section's an espionage drama about takes place here in Vancouver and the West Coast and deals really with mostly kind of with the Asia Pacific, and here we are, a pearl of the Pacific here. And I found some stories here that I've kind of, you know, some sort of natural interest to the West Coast, the Pacific region. We have a little bit of a relationship with sort of the Asian countries, and so I have a strong storyline that involves Vancouver and some of the Chinese community here. Found some great young Chinese actors, which I'm thrilled about. Mm-hmm. You know, found them in the community, a couple of stars, right? Really.
Right.
And but the story itself involves a guy who's a university professor at an intelligence agency, and he's an independent contractor, so he works under contract to the Canadian security establishment on assignment if they want to find. And in this case, they've asked him to find out a lot about what's happening with the. With the movement of money from Asia into Canada and Vancouver in particular.
Just to stop, the guy's name is, I thought was...
Wolfgang McGee.
Wolfgang McGee, yeah. I'm not sure if that... It sounds like either an old bank robber or a gold miner. Where does Wolfgang McGee come from?
Dan, it's Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Well, Wolfgang, really, I've just always really liked the name Wolfgang. Mm-hmm. And it kind of has a certain kind of a weight to it, and it kind of, you have to sort of, I think you have to be a character to kind of carry
the name. It's funny you would say that. We're friends of our son. We had all had a dinner party one night, and we said, the boy should be called Wolfgang, and they loved it, but they chickened out at the last minute. Aww. But they gave him his middle name.
Oh, yeah.
His Wolfgang.
Well, it's a great thing, but it's partly because... I lived in Germany for a while as a young man, and it was a kind of a, you know, common name. I like the name Wolf, and it has a sort of a certain bearing to it. But I just like the dual, you know, the heavy syllables to it, and it has weight to it. It has challenge to it. And he's just German-Irish. I thought that was a good combination, sort of back, or German-Scottish, but I have that kind of background of for the character. And... I kind of, a lot of people say, Wolfgang, what a handle. And I'm going, yeah, but you know, I got an idea that having a good character name, it's worked for me in the past, right?
Right.
And, kind of a heavy name, and it's never good. Rather than a common name, you know, a Bob.
Yeah, because it does come down to that, people will remember it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's...
The audience remembers it.
But the thing, I've seen the first two episodes, and I'd say the first thing is that... Who does this guy actually work for? I mean, it's a kind of a slow boil on figuring out where does this guy work for. Is he deniable his job?
Exactly. Is that... Well, it is a slow boil kind of drama. Mm-hmm. I sort of set out deliberately to do that. Mm-hmm. And also to deliberately to make it obscure who his connection to it, because he's one of those guys who really works covertly, because so if he does something that's deniable by the government, it's that arm's mm-hmm. length thing that mm-hmm. the entire intelligence world is going that way. An astounding, I think, percentage of intelligence work is done. Even the U.S., you think it has a huge intelligence arm, but I think most of that is privatized now. Up to like 80% of it
right.
is private.
But no, which is no, the not, problem, right?
Which is a huge problem. I mean, well, is
Edward
it safe
Snowden
with government
yeah.
or is it safe in private hands? Mm-hmm. We don't know. But that, the whole world is going there where everything's being sort of privatized, in, including these kind of things that are in our national interests that are... You know, private corporations don't have the same obligations or the same sort mm-hmm. of series of means tests or whatever. And I just thought that was as kind of a really good place to put a guy who was, he could be a little bit of a maverick, and he could be a, you know, distance from the government itself, so he doesn't have to toe that line. And it's just also a very good area of conflict. But really, it's also, he's an old school guy
mm-hmm.
who believes more in sort of human intelligence, human, rather than in signals intelligence and megadata.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a guy, he's kind of, and yet he's on a kind of on the edge of a losing battle in a kind of way, because megadata is mm-hmm. where it's all at now. And like, that's where everybody's going, and they get a tremendous amount of information on you. But he's kind of fighting that tide, I think, partly out of principle, you know, that it is out of. But he has a successful kind of, you know, career, and he's entered his 50s, and he's getting a little, you know, maybe he loses half a step now and then, both in his romantic kind of abilities to seduce mm-hmm. people, but also he's just getting a little bit crustier, as some of us do when we get older.
Well, that leads me directly to the question with you. With Da Vinci's, it was everybody automatically assumed it was Nick Campbell, but I mean, you were, that was you.
Well
come on, that was you.
I don't know
a
about
big
that.
Chunk of it.
Yeah.
Big chunk of it.
Well, you know, as a writer, you kind of,
right?
You know, you try to get to that point where you're, mm-hmm. you're not inventing absolutely everything, but you have some kind of sensibility where you feel, no, I know how this guy would react in any situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I do that, obviously, but. There's probably a little bit of me in all the characters,
yeah,
but,
well, hopefully.
You know, but more so in some of the, well, you certainly Da Vinci and a little bit in intelligence, yeah.
When you sit down to write this one, and knowing sort of your championing of the little guy this in the past, and those mm-hmm. stories and that idea that, you know, everybody matters, you get into this topic now, and it's so vast, as you said, and it's so corrupt, and it's so... Are you pissed off when you're writing all the time, when you're coming across information? I just somehow picture you in a room being mad.
Not ranting, but
being concerned and mad.
I'm very concerned,
yeah.
because it's encroaching on everything. It's almost hard to comprehend, really, and I think I wanted to deal with that encroachment on our lives, of everybody in the world. But it's also a noir thing of the amount of anxiety in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the amount, and this the idea that intelligence and the security states makes people safer, it doesn't make them less anxious. I think the more you hear about the intelligence matters and what they do, mm-hmm. and the revelations coming from wherever they're coming, left, right, or center, you know, is that they're very scary as to how much has already been embedded in society in terms of reporting on other people, and that matches up with a human weakness,
mm-hmm.
which is the temptation to lose power, to succumb to power, to, you know, advance up hierarchy by dealing in information or ratting out a colleague who took some paper clips or all these. I think we're a weak-willed species,
mm-hmm.
and very susceptible. And combining that with, you know, the squeeze of power and the temptation to just better yourself and get ahead in the world, it's increasing. It's almost, the level of anxiety seems to be, you know, churning forward at such a rate. You know, your children are anxious.
We've all been
anxious.
Told the American dream is the ideal,
yeah.
And it's not.
Well, and guess what happens when the American dream is shattered?
Mm-hmm. Ripple effect, right?
Yeah, there's a ripple effect, but people actually sort of hold dearer and harder to the myth when that happens.
Right.
When they seem like, oh, you can't take the myth away from me. If you take the myth away from me, I've got nothing.
You had Donald Trump.
And like, yeah. So that's how scary that is. So it's really just the whole thing's about, yes, it's in the cloth of an espionage drama, which I've always been interested in.
Right.
I am interested in people's ability to lie, and this, you know, we're all natural born liars, and that is our way. That's a survival instinct. The more information you have, that's a survival instinct is to get ahead and advantage with. If you know more about things, then...
Well, the characters in this, like I said, I've seen the first two. I mean, and I don't think that that's really representative of the series as a whole, because it's such a slow boil, and yeah, you're getting to know these. But the one thing that comes across is everybody's duplicitous. Everybody's got an ulterior motive.
Yes.
And that, from writing that standpoint, is that an easy thing to do, because you think that most people are like that? Or do you sit down, like the character of Dee Dee, who it's obviously has a chunk of Lady Macbeth to her, yeah, right? Is that one easier than, say, Rufus, who we don't know what his ulterior motive is? I'm just wondering if you go in with everybody's with that plan that they're going to all be duplicitous.
I don't.
Or do they evolve?
I'm more or less kind of treated by the circumstances that they end up in, and saying, is there an opportunity for them to be duplicitous and survive? Then the chances are that they'll take that thing. And I think that most of us, that despite our moral surety, we've never been put to the complete test.
Right.
And everybody does have a breaking point and a turning point where morality and your code of honor just flies out the window and survival kicks in. And I'm very interested in that line, because I think we all see it in our data. What I like about this is it has a lot of depth. I could write about this kind of thing for a few years, which is always kind of essential when you start a series. But it's also, I think, that really people know that they're duplicitous. And we all know kind of like what we're capable of. And we're capable of being swayed by power. I think people really don't. I think moral surety it takes courage and discipline. And the temptations are everywhere, you know, to crumble. And I think that's the part of the character stuff that I really like to see. So when you just see characters that you think, oh, this guy's... And then finally you see that it's just a fine line, that everybody really does have an area of sliding, whether they're talking about their relationships. You know, whether it's I think people can relate to telling secrets and keeping secrets from their own personal lives. They don't have to be spies to understand that, let's say, you know, you discover that the husband of one of your girlfriends is stepping out on her. Now you hold this secret. Now you've got a dilemma. Well, that's a very common thing.
Right?
You know, that's so common, as you know, or somebody's talking bad to you, or you're a colleague at work, and the colleague's going, geez, you know, I'm thinking about buying a new car, and you happen to know that they're on the short list to get sacked. What do you do?
Right.
You know, so I think people can understand these decisions in a very everyday kind of manner, and relate to relate to some of the larger questions that emerge.
How has crime changed in this city since you started writing about Vancouver specifically with Da Vinci's back? I mean, even back to a million years ago.
Yeah.
How has it changed?
Well, I don't think it's...
Has the drug changed? But you're focusing on heroin in this, which the drug's usually on the street now. The bigger issue is the meth and the crack.
Well,
but that's made here, right,
That is made here. I think heroin is an opium in particular. Heroin is a... finances covert activities, whether those are gang activities, you know, and their growth and their purchase of whatever it is they're purchasing. But it also affects globally. It's an economy. It's a black economy in which people can finance operations without having to get any approval whatsoever, because it's a black economy. You can finance an operation in Afghanistan, or you can allow a certain faction to grow it and own it if you get access to their routes of transportation or their territories, which, you know, starts overlapping into oil territories. So I pursued it that way out of interest, but also because it's an ancient drug, and in one instance it's the best anesthetic in the world.
Right.
It's the best to sort of clean pain reliever in the world, and has been for centuries. It's been known, so it's a...
And it's international.
And it's international. Everybody can either use it or get it.
Or it has to come in. Nobody's really making it here, right? Nope. It has to come in from somewhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's all that stuff leaves into me to, look into the port cities and the sort of the string of pearls around the Pacific that are now being increasingly sort of financed and invested in more and more by the Chinese economy as it overtakes the American economy, and there's this kind of expansion, slow but now even more rapid expansion by sort of Chinese economic interests that they're becoming the not the world's military leader anymore. That's the U.S. is still hanging on to that. But they are acquiring a lot more sort of territories and investments, and Vancouver's subject to some of that.
Yeah, that's an understatement right now. That's all anybody talks about, right?
Is the money pouring into Vancouver?
It's crazy, right? It's housing, that's all we talk about.
There's a lot of money being laundered.
Not all
generated by heroin or by, you know, but...
No, but...
Everybody goes hand in hand. You know, the triads work with the, you know, the
real estate
the
agents. Everybody's
and,
in, right?
Yeah. So,
everybody's got to be rich. That's the underlying theme.
Maybe that's changed in Vancouver. It's certainly what's happened in Vancouver is certainly people have become aware that the demographic of the city is changing rapidly because young people can't afford to live here. I see that, you know, the crew, you see how it affects the crew. They live in the suburbs or they're poor to an apartment downtown, if they're, you know, that kind of thing. So everybody's kind of affected by it and they become more aware of it. And so that's in everybody's sort of foremost in everybody's mind. So I try to deal with a bunch of these issues.
Well, we wouldn't be talking to you without bringing up a little bit of politics. What's aside from those things you sort of outlined there? What's in your radar right there? What gets you going? What do you think people should be talking about? I mean, this is going to run just, you know, days.
We're on the verge of an election.
Yeah.
And I think that federally, that it's a great concern to everybody, left, right, and center not necessarily specifically what party gets in, but where's the nation when we seem to have such little influence anymore and we're not participating in a global conversation, it doesn't seem to be. And the resources are fleeing the country, you know, really. I mean, we continue to be a resource. And I think everybody's become aware that infrastructure's never been developed here and we're still treating ourselves like we're an endless resource when we're so obviously not. Mm-hmm. And if we continue to be, we're a great contributor to climate change and all that kind of thing. I think it's a real shift for Canadians in their perspective of where we are in the world and our participation in it. So I'm kind of curious to see. I'm hoping that we get into some kind of coalition government, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I think that kind of a
strategic voting, that's what everybody's talking about. There's websites dedicated to it now, and it seems to be a really interesting time.
You know, just those kind of coalition governments have minority governments have served many countries well.
Right.
People complain that decisions aren't being made and can't be made quickly. Some decisions, it's great that they're not made quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So I think it's functioned well for a lot of central democracies, and I'm hoping that comes to...
I don't know if I read it somewhere or heard you say it somewhere before, is that you write for Canadians. Is that a fair?
It is.
Is it fair? Because,
you know,
can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, it's a practical kind of matter in some ways that I have to satisfy the audience that, you know, partially, the network that partially funds us.
Right, because you're back on the CBC and you've been away for a while.
Yeah, if you want to get renewed.
Not so happily, right?
If you want to get renewed, you got to get your, you know, you just can't rely on international sales. Obviously, you've got to get your primary broadcaster on side. And I address that demographic, which is basically, I think, a boomer demographic. Mm-hmm. And I've had success with them. I know that there's an audience out there that has liked my stuff in the past and will probably appreciate this. And so I kind of established that first. That's just, it's the same as music. Mm-hmm. You want to have a career, you want to build a local audience first.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go out and say, I'm going to tackle the world and address all those things and pretend. So, you know, and I'm very happy being identified as a Vancouverite and a Canadian. I feel I certainly know more. And, you know, I spent a year working in Brooklyn with on Boardwalk Empire and Scorsese's crowd and all that guy. And they're all about Brooklyn and they're all about New York, and they're very much about in the same way about their city, you know, and the stuff that they know and that they've grown up with and knowing. It just serves you better as a writer if you write about really locality. Yeah, I've said this many times also about Da Vinci and intelligence, is the more specific you become, ironically or paradoxically, the more universal you become.
Right.
And if you try to write universally, you don't really land with anybody.
Well, back to sort of the political point, I was watching a documentary the other day, and they were a documentary made by millennials talking about why millennials don't vote. And a lot of these kids, I'll use that term, say they'd much rather vote about things or spend their time on the things directly in their community now because they know that there is change there.
Yeah.
So that connection, we all want that. We've just been sort of sidetracked. Right?
Well, there's that. I mean, you know, what I see is the unrelenting, what do you call it, propaganda or just influence. It's unrelenting. It's just unrelenting now, and I think that part of that causes anxiety is just the amount of things that you're encouraged to purchase and consume, and that you're kind of, you know, that if you're not a successful consumer, you're not a successful person, you're not a successful, you know, kind of just entity at all. So yeah, it's a tough one.
We're coming back to it, though. Every one moment you think, Jesus Christ, this is the worst the world can be, and then you hear somebody say, you know, we've got to vote locally, we've got to vote this way. Like, I've never heard anybody in all my years talk so much about a federal. I just hope all the people that are on my Facebook feed or a social media feed actually vote. You can see why they don't want them people to vote online, right? Because then you know, it's that age-old game. They don't actually want anybody to vote. They just want the old rich guys to vote. That's it.
They've made it kind of difficult to vote, you know, and that's sort of been the past. And you
can't, American
and you
model
can't, and
again,
you can't blame people. I think some of the people are going, well, what difference does it make?
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have the same kind of history, maybe. And then they're saying, look, these they all appear to be the same. They all appear to lie.
Right.
They all appear to be.
Exactly.
And you see that as a young person, you just see that kind of, hey, that guy's no different than that guy. What's the point?
Yeah.
They're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a little bit of experience to and to see where you can achieve in a small area, locally, whatever.
Right. You like to use actors over and over again, and I think that's always, you know, people have caught on that.
Repertory kind of.
Yeah, is that just because you need to shoot fast? Do you need a shorthand, or is it just people that you connect with? I mean, why is that? You know,
actually, in this show, there's a few people I've worked with before, but there's a whole flock of new young people, which I really, because I felt coming into it, I couldn't go back to the same repertory company, much to the dismay of some of those people.
No, as soon as but they knew you were doing this, did you get a lot of phone calls?
Oh yeah, I'm still getting phone calls, but. It was really an attempt for me to broaden my own horizons and get to know the community. And I went out and I did, you know, a lot of pre-screening and just meet and greets with the Chinese community because I wanted to, first of all, are there the actors out there before I start writing these big storylines? Will I be able to cast? And I found fantastic talent out there. So that was I wanted to freshen myself. I just didn't want to go back, you know, because, you know, when I was doing Da Vinci and Tones, I thought I hired the best actors in town, you know. I hired them. And that's really why they sort of reappeared. These are some of the people. Of course, shorthand does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to start. But actors pick it up very quickly. They have slightly different stylistic. I wanted to try.
You have a sound to your dialogue. There's a speed. There's a cadence, right? That's obviously you.
And I love that. Mm-hmm. But I also want to see if it can adapt to different subjects, different communities, different form and stuff like that. It was really just a challenge to me, to myself. I got a challenge. You know, I want to be excited about the whole thing, all the, and a little bit on edge. I've seen people get comfortable in their roles as writers, and get duller and duller and duller and duller and duller, and they go to the same old tropes. Well, that's television does that to you, right? Because you go, okay, I've got 10, 15 episodes.
Right.
I better put it into second gear for a while and coast around. You know, people do that, and I really just didn't want to do it. I was really invigorated by going back to. We're going to work at Boardwalk.
Are you going back to work there again?
No, but I wasn't. Yeah. You know.
But is that also you're not doing 22 episodes either, right? Like, what are you doing for this one?
So few, 10.
10.
So few
yeah,
people are doing 22 anymore.
Yeah, because it's terrible, right?
Usually,
down too much.
I think it's the whole audience expectations changes is that they'll watch something for 10 episodes, and if there's a new show that replaces, they'll watch that too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just the appetite has increased. What I really like to see is when streaming and networks is that you really realize that people really are addicted to stories. Mm-hmm. And they want them, they'll consume them. So I think that's exciting.
That's a question that I have
like
for
chapters.
You. Yeah. No, that's a question I have for you. Because of the streaming services, because of Netflix and stuff, everybody, the term is binge watch television. Now, does that come into your brain now when you're writing this stuff? Because I got a sense from the two episodes, that I need to see the next ones. Whereas, you know, they're not standalones. They're not like, here's your one mystery of the week. I had a lot of questions. And frankly, I was pissed off at you a couple of times.
Yeah.
Because I had... You both, my husband and I, were watching, and he's like, "Hell, what?" But it makes the sense. So, is that in your mind now because of this new way people are watching television? That you can, here you go. You're going to sit down over the weekend. You're going to watch my show.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't, because you know, people. When I first started Da Vinci, people were a little bit annoyed with the same thing, that I wouldn't resolve things.
Yeah.
They say like, and so I kind of like that ongoing, because to me, if you get interesting characters, you want to go with them, sort of. Through all their different things, and things take time. And I wanted to risk people being, I wanted to both intrigue people, but I wanted to let people know that this is a bit of a slower burn. You know, I sort of that challenging that, because everywhere I've been going for the past, you know, years is you go into pitch to a network guy and they're saying, I need something that's noisy. That was a word, you know, for a couple of years.
It
was like, I would need a noisy show, you know, which means...
Gun chases or car
spectacle.
Chases and spectacle?
You know, can I advertise?
A dead hot chick
grab?
Right at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly, that kind of thing. And they want, and I'm going, you know what? I'm an adult. I actually am looking for something else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a niche.
You're lucky that you've been able to keep this niche for all these years.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Who do you have pitch yourself? Like, what? I mean, obviously I'm being facetious because you have success with it, but lots of people would have turned that page and gone for what they want, gone for the money, or gone for just bigger budgets to play with. I mean, there must be part of you as a creative person.
All those things are very tempting, but I've also stepped into that world and I've tasted the... what happens, I can also, when you agree to do something that you're not quite sure of, but the money looks good and it's a bigger network and stuff like that, because certainly after Intelligence, I was in the U.S. and, you know, pitching and getting pilots in the U.S., and I'm just going, okay, you know, and what have I done here, because I'm really not into it. The thing that working here in Canada with the CBC allows me is I can actually talk about things that might affect or criticize the status quo. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anywhere else, no matter if you're Breaking Bad or whatever else. These aren't critical of the status quo.
Yeah.
They're entertainments.
Right.
And I found that to be true in the U.S., that there's television generally doesn't let any critics on board, because networks recognize that it's a powerful medium.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everybody recognizes it's a powerful medium. And they really don't want too many dissenting voices on it, because what television is about, after all, most of it, commercial television, is getting you to buy something.
That's subscription stuff, though, will maybe help fix that.
Subscription stuff has changed it entirely, because people are now, not only is it a great economic model for people, because these subscriptions are paying direct money to these networks. I mean, huge deal, you know, and these guys are picking up a lot of, and they can afford to throw a lot of money at, so they've attracted all the guys from the film world. So now a guy, I'm still at the bottom of the line, you know, because they've got everybody. They got the Ridley Scott, they got everybody coming from film, and it's a good thing, though. Storytelling, binge
watching. But you can have those stories. I mean, I think, I'm not blowing smoke, but I think the only time that some of those stories didn't go bigger for you was just basic budget. Do you work with the same crew over and over all the years?
I try to get a lot of the same people back. I have a lot of the same crew, but a lot of new people, which I like. You know, you kind
of
go scary.
I don't know these people. It's part of your job, though, isn't it? Really, as being
search,
a creative person,
search
in the,
out
right?
talent.
And to encourage it. Somebody encouraged you at some point, I would imagine, right?
You know, it's the greatest thing to see people so happy that. To be working on
when you worked on MacGyver, I've always wanted to ask you, did you work with Henry Winkler directly then too? Was he in there then?
Henry showed up every few months, but I was only there for a couple of half seasons,
okay.
Right? But he'd show up in flat hand.
I always thought, nice I'm doing TV stuff with all those TV critics, I thought he was always one of the nicer guys to talk to. I always had a good time when you saw him at anything.
He's a very nice guy.
Plus, when you're my age, you know, the Fonz was the greatest thing that ever happened.
He's a nice guy, but he's always been a really prolific producer for a long time, and he encouraged a lot of people.
I love the movie Night Shift too, that was hilarious.
Yeah. So he's a guy, you know, just some
so
people.
Before I let you go, after we've gone through everything and people that know you and know your work, so about romantic comedy in your future, have you ever you ever gonna lighten up?
I hope not.
No. There you go. That's
I'm perfect. Interested in what I write. I gotta find something that I'm interested in, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of with this show. I've tried to take the same attitude, even though the expectations for this are big, you know, stuff like that, is that I think one of the reasons that Da Vinci succeeded was because I felt in the first couple of years, I kept saying to people, like, this is an experiment. Let's not tighten up too fast. Mm-hmm. So you're in the first year, you're always finding there's I think you should be seeking what the show is going to be, right? And not go forward like this is the determined. The show starts talking to you pretty quickly and telling you what it can do and what it can't do. And not probably different than making an album where you make a bunch of cuts and you go, wow, that's where we started. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's telling us this. And if you don't respond to it, you're kind of, even have to throw some good stuff away. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel. It's like, this is my first season, is I'm testing the parameters. What's it about? How's this working? Do I have enough money to make the show I want to make?
Right.
And it's very tough in Vancouver right now. You know,
is it less budget than you had for Da Vinci's?
It's about the same budget. But the fact
10,
is that,
15 years later.
Yeah, is that, you know, you've got locations that shut you out. You've got Warner Brothers spending
everything's shooting here, right?
$255 million. Mm-hmm. Over a period of about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
That's
here in Vancouver.
Nobody can find.
So no locations.
Locations anymore.
Do you miss Da Vinci? Do you miss that character?
Oh, yeah.
Do you miss that
totally.
Voice?
I wish.
That was a bit of lightning in a bottle to you struck, I think, with the actor and the guy. It was like Gandolfini for Tony Soprano.
Oh,
you couldn't imagine.
Nick was it.
Yeah.
You know? But I knew that going in. Yeah. I kind of had a sense of him, and I really wrote for him. So, and that doesn't happen that often, that you kind of get this, boom, that guy, and he's available, and he wants to do it. I don't know him, but, you know.
That voice, because you were such a voice through that guy, right? Like, you turned, you know, with the Missing Women's, with everything, before anybody was talking about it, you were talking about it.
I miss having...
Miss your soapbox?
I miss having, not so much the soapbox.
I mean that in a good sense, by the way.
Yeah. No, I miss working with Nick. And he's an exceptional...
He's a handful,
guy.
Yeah.
He's a handful, but he's a great
beautiful
actor.
On camera, though, and great actor, yeah.
And he can handle anything, mm-hmm. and he just... He's just one of those actors, so yeah, it's a gift. But he also, he embodied the character, brought it to life. Right?
Yeah.
And his son's here.
Oh, yeah?
Hanging on set today. And, I do miss it. I miss City Hall, quite frankly. I would have liked to have seen City Hall.
I
would have liked to have been writing City Hall now and addressing some of the issues in the city, you know, because obviously the city's under huge pressure.
Obviously, you're stuck. You're in this one. You're almost finished, though, shooting it, aren't you, this season?
We have a couple of days on this episode and another episode.
And you're directing this one?
Yes.
How many did you direct in this season?
This will be my third.
Okay.
And not something I generally want to do.
No, you don't normally.
But I really like to try to find directors that I do have a shorthand with, because it's hard to sort of bring a director up to speed and kind of speak through their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the guys like David Frazee, who's done, I've done half of them, and Steven Sergic, who did some of the others. Shorthand with a director for me is like essential. Mm-hmm. Essential if you're trying to start up and go like this. Now, if I go into a second season, I might, bring on work somebody into the where they can see what we're doing and stuff like that. It's hard to break in a director because really you're just over the shoulder all the time telling him, and that's no good for that guy,
right?
Either, and it's frustrating on both ends. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's the same thing with DOPs, cameramen. It's key creatives. You want to work with people, you know.
So that was Canadian. I guess treasure, really. Chris Haddock. He's back on TV, as you heard in that interview, with the new espionage drama called The Romeo Section, CBC, Wednesday nights at 9. You can also read further about that show at theprovince.com. I wrote a piece about that about a week ago. So anyways, check it out. I've always been a big fan. I think he's one of the best writers we have for TV. Actually, he's just interesting. And the fact that he takes our actual stories and turns them into... TV dramas is fantastic. Now, talking about taking stories, real stories, and turning them into a bit of fiction, Elizabeth Hay is no stranger to that. Her new novel, His Whole Life, as you'll hear in this interview, she sort of takes from her own life and a relationship with her son. It's a fantastic read, as I said earlier. I plowed right through it. Now, those of you who are fans of Elizabeth Hay and don't know this, she will be at the Vancouver Writers' Fest. That's on October 20th to 25th. She's doing a handful of different events, so you can look that up online. But in the meantime, time. I caught up with her when she was at a book fest, the very first year for this one, I think, in Salmon Arms. So here's my chat with Elizabeth Hay. Good morning, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us on the DGP podcast. I guess we found you in Salmon Arm today, right?
I'm in Salmon Arm, remembering the Salmon Arm salute. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, Pierre Trudeau going by on the train, right?
Yes, he was on holiday with his sons, and people caught wind of it, and so there were hecklers who greeted them in Salmon Arm.
Well, there you go.
He gave them the famous finger.
That's where you could go around town and relive it, maybe.
That's right. Well, I passed the train station the other day where it happened.
So are you're there at a writer's festival or book signing? What are you doing there?
It's a book fest. Mm-hmm. It's called the Shuswap Book Fest. Mm-hmm. And this is the first year. So there are just two events. They have Eleanor Wachtel the first night giving a talk about books. She of course, is the host of Writers and Company.
Yes,
and then they have me the next night being interviewed by Alex Hawley, who lives in Kelowna, a novelist and writer whose book has been longlisted for the Giller Prize.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that you're there at an event like this, because one of the things, before we start talking about your new novel, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is our writers' festivals. In fact, you'll be coming to Vancouver's soon.
Right, that's right.
Just talk to me a little bit about the importance of these festivals or what you even get out of them on the other side of it. I know, obviously, the public lines up to hear their favorite authors speak, but I was wondering from your side, what do you get out of them?
Well, it's actually pretty wonderful to have readers gathered for you, you know, and be able to meet with them and talk with them, but at the same time you're with other writers. So it's very companionable. You get to meet people you've never met before, other writers I mean by that. And so it's a gathering in two senses. It brings you together with other writers. It brings you together with readers. And in this current landscape where we have very few bookstores and very little media coverage, actually, festivals are kind of a remaining bulwark on behalf of books and writers and readers.
It gets you out of the house, too, and I don't mean that in a flippant fashion. I mean the quiet life of a writer, right?
It does. It gets you out of the house. Absolutely. I'm doing more traveling in these weeks, you know, September, October, and into November than I normally do, but not by a long stretch. I tend to never stray too far from my desk.
And where's your desk? Where do you do all your writing?
Well, my desk is in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And I've lived there since 1992, and I like it. You know, I've become fond of Ottawa. It may be the national capital, but it's out of the swim.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Toronto. It's not Vancouver. It's not Montreal. You know, it's a smaller place. I know a few writers, but we really don't talk about writing. We talk about other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have a quiet, private, peaceful life, mm-hmm. really.
Just going back a little bit, when you said about to have the writers and festivals are important now because of bookstores shuttering, I mean, that was always a good chance for an author to meet their readers, too, is at signings at those mom-and-pop bookshops and give readings. But, you know, in the last little while, the story sort of percolating to the top is that the actual printed book is making a comeback, that the e-readers...
That's good news, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really great news. Tell me what you think about it, yeah.
I find it heartening. I wouldn't have known that except that I have a book out, and so I've been talking to booksellers,
mm-hmm.
and this is the story they give me, which is that a couple of years ago, e-sales or e-book sales mm-hmm. plateaued, and the printed word is coming back to the fore. Well, I don't know how strongly, but that's mm-hmm. the trend. You know, that's the trend, and that people find reading on a screen reminds them too much of work.
Yeah.
And the other complaint they have is that they can't flip back and reread something very easily and then return to the spot.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you know, a book is just the simplest and most restful technology. All you do is you open it, and then you close it.
Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, for readers that if we grew up with books, it's the idea of just holding them, just having that in your hands, right?
I think so.
It's kind of an automatic feeling of escapism in a way, right? You can just go anywhere with this.
That's right. You enter a private world. It's you, the book, the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes if there is the lament that a big book is too heavy to hold when you're propped up in bed. That's where a Kindle or a Kobo can come in handy. I understand that. But I love to hold a book.
Yeah, really. And how big is the book that it? You're sitting in the bed with a giant coffee table book. I mean, come on. Well,
right.
Speaking of, we get to. I appreciate your thoughts on those things. We get to it though. His Whole Life is your latest novel that's come out. I have to tell you, I'm three quarters of the way through. I have developed a massive crush on Jim.
Oh, have you?
I just love him. He's like he's like a kind of sweeter, nicer Huck Finn to me in a way.
Yes. Well, and he's kind of the boy I wanted to have.
Yeah.
I mean, I love my son like crazy, but there are certain ways he drives me nuts, and one is that he's always been really anti-Canada.
Mm.
He was born in New York City,
right?
Because that's where we happened to be living. And when he was four, we came north to Ottawa, and for me, it was coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reasons, difficulties growing up at school, not being a hockey player, he kind of developed this anti-Canadian attitude,
mm-hmm.
right? Which and then he loved to rub that in. So we would have these constant arguments about Canada. And there are a couple of things I wanted to do in the book. One was to have a boy who loved Canada.
Mm-hmm. That was from New York, so it replicates your son in a sense of location,
in a sense,
right?
Sure, it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jim in the book is an American boy with a Canadian mother, an American father.
Mm-hmm.
So he has these divided loyalties. He's tugged between his mother and a father, and he's tugged between the U.S. and Canada. But he has a real fondness and appreciation for Canada that I wished that my own son had.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I did in the book was I gave Jim a dog. My own son wanted a dog, and for various complicated reasons, I never gave him a dog, which I regret deeply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think his years in public school and high school would have been much easier had he had a dog.
Hmm.
So you know, that's what you do in a book, right?
Right.
In fiction, you can make up for some of the mistakes that you made in life.
Mm-hmm. It's the other thing, you know, that's interesting that, you know, obviously it's got I don't know if autobiographical might be a bit strong, but there's obviously, as a writer, you write things that you know.
I do. I always start with something personal.
Mm.
And it can be small, or it can be big, depending on the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I started with that boy, who in certain ways is very much like my son, in other ways not. And then I sort of worked out a fictional world for these
mm-hmm.
people.
How old is your son now?
Well, he just turned 27.
And what did he think of Jim?
Well,
did he give you a bit of a look?
Well, you know, last summer,
mm-hmm.
which in fact is two summers ago, because, so I don't mean this very past summer, I mean the summer before,
right.
When I was struggling to finish the editing of the book,
mm-hmm.
I, in a fit of desperation, begged him to read it, because he hadn't read any of my books. Even though he's a big reader, he avoided reading his mother so as not to be embarrassed, which I understand totally.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked him if he would read this manuscript, and he did, and he was terrific about it.
Right.
In two ways. One, totally sympathetic and encouraging and supportive, and two, he had excellent editing advice.
Oh.
You know, about how to, you know, what to play up, maybe what to play down, and he gave me further insights into Jim, into a boy, the life of a boy, the mind of a boy. And that was incredibly helpful to me.
What does your son do for a living?
Well, he's an English literature student.
Oh, okay.
Big surprise. But at the moment,
crazy talk, Elizabeth.
At the moment, he's living in England, living in Cambridge. He has a job working for a small academic press.
Right.
As an editor.
Mm-hmm. So by him taking that, having that manuscript and going through it, and him not reading your stuff before, did that open up another chapter or a door in your relationship with your own son, giving him this fictional son to have a look at?
Well, I think it did.
Yeah.
Yes. I think he... I'll tell you one concrete thing that happened is I thought, wow, I've got this ace up my sleeve. From now on, I'm going to give everything I write to my son to edit. Make use of him.
There you go. Get it edited before somebody else gets their hands on it.
Yeah.
Getting back to the book, you know, like I said, I love Jim. I think you've nailed the 11-year-old boy. Well, I guess that's not the right way to say it. I think you've really presented him in a great fashion at that sort of age before, you know, he's still a kid, but he's on the verge of trying to sort of break away from his mother at the same time.
Yes. Yeah.
But again, you know, not to gush too much, but I also wanted him and Nan and Lulu to just paddle off in a canoe and start their own life on an island somewhere. Because I thought the relationship between the three of them, like I said, I'm only just about three quarters way or just over halfway through. The relationship of the three of them, I think, is really beautiful.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that a lot. I really do. For me, it was too. I was very, very fond of Jim. And of Nan, and very fond of Lulu.
Mm-hmm.
She's the friend, Nan's friend, who sort of blows in and brings this whole burst of energy that the two of them needed, you know, Nan and Jim needed.
Well, reminds Nan that she can do things. She can look after herself, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And it's a friendship. I mean, for Nan and Lulu, who are, you know, either 50 or almost 50, respectively. They've been through a lot in life. They've lost a lot, and here they are. They're recapturing a childhood friendship that kind of when they were 11, 12, and friends, they rescued each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, this is a second rescue. They're coming into each other's lives. They're rescuing each other again, and they're not about to lose each other this time. So, despite their political disagreements, which are pretty fierce, they don't let that destroy the friendship, which I think is a decision you can make when you're more mature.
Right, right. You can have disparate choices.
Yeah.
What about the idea that they're, you know, it's a very much a coming of age story for the young boy, for various reasons. But what about them? Do you get I get a bit of a sense that they're sort of, whether it's their second age, but they're coming of age again.
Well, the coming of age for Nan, what would we say that is? I mean, by the...
Realizing she doesn't need a grumpy old man in her life, or...
Yeah, well, you know, she's married, yeah, that triangle of the family is the boy, the father and mother, and the boy and the mother are very close. The father is this... disappointing father and irritating husband. And so Nan really, when the book begins, is on the verge of leaving him, at least in her own mind, she's on the verge of leaving him. That doesn't happen for reasons that you discover when you read the story. But in the end, she is without a husband. And you can also see that she's about to be without a son because this is the nature of family life. Children become adults, and they leave. The family disperses. And so she is entering a period in her life of greater solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And Lulu, who is this actor, unemployed actor at the age of 50, my daughter, you know, my daughter is 29, and she's a struggling actor. So I kind of put some of her experience to Lulu. And But at the end, she's got a part. You know, she's got a she's got a role again. Because I wanted her, of course, to have this second burst of creativity. And then people have told me, well, you have to write a sequel to this. You have to show us what becomes of Jim and what becomes of Lulu and what becomes of Nan and her estranged son, because actually she has two.
Right,
sons.
She has the older son and the 20-year-old, right?
And I must admit that it was hard enough to write this book without thinking about writing a sequel, but maybe, you know.
Maybe, you never
maybe
know.
Down the road I might read it.
But, you know, there's something beautifully said about, you know, when, whether it's a great book ends or even a great TV show or movie, that it's left into the hands of the person who's enjoying it to decide.
That's right.
What's happened to them, you know? It's something to be said to letting them sort of live on in everybody's individual imagination.
Quite right. I think I'll take your advice.
Well, it's just, I'm not telling you what to do, Elizabeth A. It's before we... well, one of the other things that stands out in this novel, obviously, is that where you chose to set it in the mid-1990s when Quebec is, you know, boiling over. And
yep.
We all, you know, remembered that very, very much as that it came pretty close. And just a couple of questions that came to mind with that is, one, going back and setting a book, you know, in the sort of recent past, is that mm-hmm. easier or harder to do in the fact that people remember it so well? And also, why this time? Why Quebec?
Well, so that was 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
which that kind of falls within the amount of distance I need.
Okay.
20, 30 years ago, with Late Nights on Air, I was returning to the time of the Berger inquiry into the Mackenzie Valley gas pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
30 years had gone by. And that seems to be the length of time I need in order to revisit something that's happened.
Hmm. Do you choose that specifically, or does it you just all of a sudden realize that's where you are again?
That's sort of what I realize.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, it's not so much a choice as a need, maybe.
Right.
If I'm writing a short story, it can be about something that happens 5 minutes ago,
right,
or something happening now. But a novel, time is different, and you're dealing with a big flow of time, and I need to have a bit of a distance on certain key events. And the reason for the referendum is that I thought it was such a dramatic moment in this country's history, begging actually to be written about. And what I wanted to do was just to explore how that whole question of Quebec not being able to make up its mind whether to leave or to stay, but with this great yearning to leave, you know, and yet staying, how that has played on our imagination as Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's been the key political story, one of them anyway, almost my whole life.
Mm. It keeps coming back, right?
And it keeps coming back. And so I thought, you know, I wanted to have this family on the verge of staying together and coming apart. I wanted to have Nan, you know, caught, right?
Mm-hmm.
And caught in an understandable way. She wants to leave, but feels she can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually helps her understand the mentality in Quebec.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job of that as well. You gave a story that you would say to someone now can seem a little bit dry on the surface because, you know, politics for a lot of people automatically hits that way. But there's so much passion in that ideal. And I don't even mean idea, I mean ideal of people about that you either, you know, that you have a part in it about Bouchard and how she can't stand him,
yep,
the look of him, but then part of her, she says, but I get it. I get where he's come, you know, there's an emotional attachment to it. And I think, and you know, when you opened the interview this morning talking about Trudeau giving the finger, I think that he was a character or a person that existed with him as well, right? You know?
Yeah, such, you know, these...
The resolve.
And these characters are well, they're Canadian characters,
mm-hmm.
and they're huge. They fill a big screen, and we, I wanted to do justice to that, right? Not to think, oh, this is a dry, as you say, a dry chapter in our past that we're not going to think about anymore, and we're going to just concentrate on you know, shopping and how much money we're making. And I wanted to enter the imaginative landscape of this country and some of the questions that are ongoing, and they're deep questions. You know, they're deep questions about who we are, who we want to be.
Well, it's interesting too, is that, you know, Canada, in the big realm of things, is, you know, Canada, everybody's so nice, everybody, but how many other countries in the world actually go through legitimate succession issues? Like, actually get to that point. I mean, crazy people in Alaska say that around every election time, you know, some very crazy libertarians that want to do whatever. They're like, we're going to succeed. Well, no, but we actually have, it happens here.
Yes, that's
right. It gets
right
to the point. Like, it's you know, it's a big deal.
It is a big deal. And so there's this apparent stability, mm-hmm. right? That's the impression that,
right.
that Canada gives, and the impression that we have. And at the same time, we know just exactly how precarious that is.
Mm-hmm. That's what makes us unique, I guess, huh?
Well, unique and not unique. because
that's the unique part.
that's true. Mm-hmm. That's true of anyone anywhere, that life, however apparently stable, mm-hmm. in fact, is on the verge of falling apart. You know, I can step outside and be hit by a car at any second. And I can do that anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's universal in that sense, mm-hmm. that notion that life is so precarious.
Right. Well, Elizabeth, on that cheerful note, I'm just kidding. Congratulations on the book. I can hardly wait to finish it.
I'm so pleased you're enjoying it.
I am enjoying it, but I'm not sure if I want to know what Jim's going to be like later in life, but I'll leave that to your hands. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Right.
Bye-bye.
You can't write code. You're not an engineer. You're not a designer. You can't put a hammer to a nail. I built the circuit board. The graphical interface was stolen from Xerox PARC. Jeff Raskin was the leader of the Mac team before you threw him off his own project. Everything, someone else designed the box. So how come 10 times in a day I read Steve Jobs as a genius? What do you do?
I play the orchestra. And you're a good musician. You sit right there. You're the best in your role.
Alrighty, it's time for movies here on the DGP. That was a clip you heard from the new film Steve Jobs. It's officially Oscar bait season when you see these big actors in these sort of biopics and very chatty films. Jim Gordon from CTV is on the phone with me. We're going to talk about these movies. Now, Jim, right off the bat, Steve Jobs, Aaron Sorkin wrote this one, and it's pretty obvious that Aaron Sorkin wrote this one, isn't it?
Oh, you and I were saying this during the movie screening, that if you watched West Wing, or if you watched The Newsroom, or The American President, and even The Social Network, this is just, it's the way he likes to write dialogue. Keep people moving, keep them talking back and forth over each other, and then make sure one or two people have quirky lines.
Well, yeah, it's the classic walking and talking, that's his thing, and there's a lot of walking and talking in this. There's a lot of talking, but, you know, at the end of the day, you come back to, if there's a lot of talking and it's Aaron Sorkin that's putting the words in their mouth, I can pretty much live with that.
So could I, absolutely.
Yeah. So this is directed by Danny Boyle, too, which is interesting. Kind of an interesting combination. Danny Boyle has taken this very sort of staid look. We should tell people to look at Steve Jobs, played here wonderfully by Michael Fassbender. Just like to say Fassbender like that. Wasn't there some sort of weird B movie? Fassbender? No, Faster Pussycat. What is that? I don't know what I'm thinking.
Dana G will be right back with more references.
So anyways, Danny Boyle gets his hands on this one, and what was I just saying? Oh, yeah, so basically the movie, to tell people, it's Steve Jobs from the span of 1984 to 1998, and it's a look at three product launches, him just before preparing for the product launches, and the last one is up to the iMac. I thought it was a great way to handle this very large story. I like the fact that Steve Jobs, I mean, I'm not shy to say that I think he's a giant jerk. I live with a musician. iTunes did nothing but take money out of musicians' pockets. He was single-minded in his vision of what he wanted to do, but he didn't make any of the things that he used. I mean, he's a hell of a marketer. And this really shows you that. It really shows you his intrepid nature and his also take-no-prisoners nature, and also how he basically just stepped over everybody that helped him along the way. And I guess that's how he ended up being worth, you know, $8 billion or $8 billion, grillion, schmillion dollars. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know a lot more about his history than I do. I think, as you said the other night, this is the way they had to present it because it was the only way they're going to keep this big story under 2 hours, and it's like 2 hours and 2 minutes. If you got a, you know, traditionally standard biopic, it could have easily been done into the three-hour mark. And I like the fact that it was very confined, that he seeks perfection in the Apple products, and when you see him throughout the whole movie, and it's just his life at those various stages, as you mentioned, he's looking for perfection, and he can't stand that he doesn't have perfection in his own personal life.
Yeah,
and just the people he steps over, and you see it throughout with Seth Rogen as Steve Wozniak and Kate Winslet with an odd accent that goes in and out, but that aside, in her life and everybody else, that he just he was looking at the forest and everybody else was the tree makers, but he didn't make anything.
No, he didn't make anything except made people crazy. And it's, sort of a half thread through this is his relationship with his daughter, who he never really acknowledges at the beginning anyways that he was an actual father, because there's only a 94.3% chance that he's the biological father. Yes, folks, it gets that nerdy that it, when it comes down to who's the parent. You just mentioned him there, the Steve Wozniak character, who was the brains of the operation when it comes down to Apple. He's the guy. He's the code writer. He built the board, everything. And he's played here by Seth Rogen. And you and I, again, we had this conversation. We should tell people we're not having this conversation in the movie theaters, though, even though we do whisper on occasion. Seth Rogen was very good as Steve Wozniak. It was such a treat to see Seth Rogen not in a role where he's not going, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's not just the fat stoner kid. I thought he did a really good job with this.
But you know, as you mentioned with him, with Jobs and his role, just the relationship between the two of them, Wozniak's the guy that's the builder. Jobs is the guy that has the, I guess, prophetic insight to say, no, we're not having two slots on that Macintosh. And all the experts are going, no, but you have to. And he's going, no. Like, I don't know what you chalk that up to. I mean, that was his genius, I guess.
Well, no, he wanted the two slots. They wanted more. And he realized, I think his bigger vision, and you have to give this guy, was that he knew what the potential for this was and what it would mean in a monetary fashion, how to monetize it. Because it basically opens the film with that. They're sort of guessing what they're going to sell after he launches. I guess it's the first was Apple II, I think it was, in 84. But that's, so he had a closed-end computer, and everybody said, no, that's wrong. And now at the end of the day, we've all got, you know, offices and bags full of Mac products that only work with Mac products.
Yep.
So I think that's 1-0 Steve Jobs on that one. I like the film. I thought it was good. I thought it was a really great way to present somebody. I like that Jeff Daniels showed up as the sort of kindly CEO that helped him along the way and then gets screwed and then screws him. Aaron Sorkin loves Jeff Daniels. He uses him all the time. So he's got that great, that great sort of, I don't know, you just sort of trust him. Kate Winslet, you're right, she plays Joanna Hoffman, who was a very pivotal woman in Steve Jobs' life, a very pivotal character, male or female. Yeah, you're right. It took her a little while to get that Polish accent warmed up, but once she did, because you don't recognize
halfway through
her.
The movie, all of a sudden, oh, yes, we knew she was from Poland, and now she has a slight accent to prove it.
Yeah, the longer she was in America, the thicker her accent got.
Yeah,
it's funny how that works.
And you're right about Daniels, though. He in this movie, he plays, the former Pepsi CEO.
John Scully, yeah.
John Scully. So, and Daniels just brings that kind of character to the table that can be very firm, but is a likable character. And I don't know much about John Scully, but he was great in this movie.
Well, he does the mentor role really well, and he can do the preachy role really well. I think and he's just got a, he's got an ear for Sorkin's dialogue too. Just one other thing I wanted to point out: the woman who plays Chris Ann, who's the mother of the child that he won't recognize, even though 94.3% chance that he is the father, is played by Catherine Waterston. And yes, that same last name, that's Sam Waterston's daughter.
Well, she had that great breakthrough last year in Joaquin Phoenix's movie, which kind of got half and half of the critics, and I'm drawing a blank.
Oh, the Paul Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson one about L.A. What was that called, right? Yeah. Raymond Chandler? Was it a Raymond Chandler novel it was based on? I can't remember. Yeah, it's so great to see it because I digress, but I love Sam Waterston. Love, love, love him.
Oh yeah, who doesn't?
So we're both on the yay to Steve Jobs. I'm a happy 7.5. I'm happy 8 out of 10 actually for this one. I think it was interesting.
Exactly what I would give it. Yeah.
Yeah, we're good with that. Look at us, Jim Gordon, agreeing away.
I mean, we're not in the same room.
Is that why? Oh, so distance makes the critic's mind grow fonder. Is that it?
Yeah.
No. All right.
I like the way you just spit that out. That's
I know. I'm fantastic. It's because I'm tired. Okay. Next one we're going to talk about. We'll play a clip first. Is the new Guillermo del Toro? I guess. Thriller/horror film, Crimson Peak.
She knows who I am and she wants me to leave.
Nonsense, my dear. You're not going anywhere.
You had a bad dream? You were sleepwalking.
No. I'm afraid I shall go mad if I stay.
My darling, you're imagining things. Tomorrow, why don't we go out to the post office? I think some fresh air would do you good.
No. I have to leave. I have to get away from here.
Edith, this is your home now. You have nowhere else to go.
Alrighty, hopefully that made a few people jump. It's hard to do it without seeing it because this is a very visual movie. In fact, I thought it was a movie that was a throwback to like the sort of early Hollywood creepy movies, you know, with the old candelabras, the mansions that creak. You know, it's a story, I guess I would tell first. It's a story of a young woman who wants to be a writer, and her father is this great industrialist, I guess, in, where were they, in Buffalo?
Buffalo in 1901.
This creepy couple comes from England to looking for some money for their invention, and actually, basically, they're both just a partnership of gold diggers, which I'm not giving anything away, because you figure that out pretty fast. The young woman falls in love with the man, who's played by Tom Hiddleston, who, again, is one of my favorites now. He's so great. You slick back that dark hair and put a bit of powder on him. He just looks super creepy. Jessica Chastain is this. The young woman is played by Mia Wasikowska. I think that's how you say that name. So it all goes bad. She goes and she moves into the creepy mansion. Now, Jim, tell our listeners really about this mansion because you had such good lines about it last night.
Well, I mean, it's as you said, it's visually stunning. It's a throwback to the like Roger Corman, Mike Hammer movies. But the mansion, you and I couldn't stop laughing because they get to this mansion, and of course, it's kind of a take on what Downton Abbey has referred to before. Where you get the wealth or the guy with the title and no money, and American money with no title. So they bring her over to this mansion that literally has no roof.
Yeah, it's like what I think her line is. She says, "Oh my, it's colder inside than is outside," and it's like England in winter. So
yeah, and it's Cumberland. Built on this red clay, so you've literally got the walls bleeding this bright, what a shock, blood red. But the whole movie, every time there's a serious moment, you just see snow falling.
No matter
where they
melts.
Are in the house, because it's just the roof goes right through to the basement. So she's in the basement, she's in a room, it doesn't matter. Wherever she is, there's just light snow coming down.
I know we decided, because we had a conflict with another film for this, and we both agreed we wanted to see this film over the other film because of it's a Del Toro movie and because, you know, of Pan's Labyrinth. We all just thought that was such a remarkable movie.
Yeah.
And this going back to the creepy monster, or the scary thing, because in between he did that Pacific Rim, which was, you know, science fiction monsters, is still. Doesn't have the same, you know, this seemed like we were going to get a good creep out of him again. And I didn't find it creepy. I didn't find it really scary. A few jumps at the beginning, I might have squeezed your arm. But
yeah.
It was so, because of the setting, I just knew exactly what was going to happen behind every door. He does deliver the creepy ghost with the long finger. He likes people with really long fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
Piano
But
players.
It's funny, I guess, because I had a couple of people ask me today about, Is it scary? Is it scary? And I would say it's not what we're used to lately, is that paranormal activity scary,
right.
Which less is more. You're right. In the first 5 minutes, you and I looked at each other and went, oh, geez, I don't like scary movies. I don't think I'm going to last.
Mm-hmm.
But it got less and less scary and more kind of just creepy. And there's some other things with the brother and the sister and all that we won't give away. But it's nowhere near as scary as the commercial or the trailer would lead you
Absolutely.
To believe.
Yeah, I wasn't. Once they got to the creepy house, I thought, okay, this is going to be super creepy. And it really was like, you know, bloody bodies and bathtubs. Well, we've seen that before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it was. Yeah. I'd still give this about a 6.5 out of 10 because I'll watch anything that Del Toro makes because it's visually it's like a painting. But
yeah, it's stunning.
You and I were also saying, I guess he is so well respected that someone like Jessica Chastain, who is on a real, real roll right now, she must have just said, "I don't care what it costs me or what I got to do. I want to work with this guy."
Yeah, and you get to dress up in those period costumes and have a bit of fun, I guess. But
I guess.
I thought, you know, I'm with you on that. I'm a little bit lower, maybe about a 6. I got a bit bored. It didn't scare me. And then I thought, oh well, here we go. And also the bad character didn't die the way I wanted them to die, so I'm disappointed.
Yeah,
by that.
Yeah.
I wanted
a little bit more. But you're right. It starts out where you think this is going to be really bumpy and scary, but it just is. It's still worth seeing, but it's not the kind of scary we've seen lately. Like, and I'm thinking of the Black Widow and movies like that that are pretty scary. This showed too much, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm gonna play a clip now from Biba Boys. Now, Jim, you didn't see this one, but you're gonna hang around and chat with me about this because you're a bon vivant and can speak about all sorts of things. Okay, so here's attaboy. Here's Biba Boys.
Anyway, we talk about you all. It's hot, steaming, it's okay to cry. We know what our sons do, Jeet. ਡਰਗਾਂ ਵੇਚਦੇ ਨੇ ਮਾਰ ਕੁਟਾਈ ਕਰਦੇ ਨੇ and shoot with guns. And I don't like it. I want to interrupt Nagar. If you change, Vaigru de Apar Kirpa. And if you don't, I choose not to know.
What am I supposed to say?
Nothing. Just know your mother is no dummy.
All right, that is the new film from Canadian director Deepa Mehta. You know, she did the Elemental series, Water, Fire, whatever else, and the adaptation of the Salman Rushdie book, Midnight's Children. She's back with a gangster movie, or at least her version of a gangster movie. She said she really wanted to do a gangster movie and looked at a bunch of them. My opinion is she should go back and look at them again because this movie is terrible. Oh, my God. You know what? And I'm going to say a little bit in a minute about her, but I went to it and I was laughing. I was laughing out loud at just the choices in the script and the language. So what you've got is a group of the only thing that's interesting and fresh about this, and you know what? I'll give it to anybody. It's pretty hard to do a fresh gangster film. It's pretty hard. You know, you've got some basic archetypes and tropes there that you have to touch on. Otherwise, it's not a gangster film. But in this case, it's a group of Indo-Canadian gangsters situated here in the Lower Mainland. You know, people said, oh, it's based on some true stories. Yeah, well, okay. The main guy, there's one thing that maybe come close to a story we went through was the, you know, remember the Gillian Guest thing with Peter Gill? Yeah. The sleeping with the juror. That was that big trial with Bindi Johal. Well, that happens in this. But otherwise, it's just, I don't even think the gangsters here are as dumb as these guys are in this movie. I just thought it was insulting. It was dumb. It was hackneyed. You know, it's funny, they're all dressed in these crazy bright suits, and they're all these archetypes, and they even list at the beginning what they are. You know, he's the jokester, he's the tough guy. It's like we couldn't figure that out on our own. Like, it was literally a chyron under their names. So long story short, I didn't like the movie at all when I saw it, and then I actually interviewed Deepa Mehta, and I came to even dislike the movie even further. It was funny. I asked about the clothes, because the clothing on these guys, if you've seen in the posters, and I think quite a few people have, she got mad at me and sort of called it reverse racism in a way that I wouldn't say that if there were Italian mobsters in those clothes and blah, blah, blah. Well, for starters...
The poster, like, I haven't seen the movie. Again, I'll acknowledge that, but you're right about the poster. Like, I would assume it's a comedy.
Right, and you're not going to see Tony Soprano and those guys dressed up like Skittles.
Sky Masterson and Guys and Dolls.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, these guys look like, their clothing look like Skittles. They were the color of Skittles. I can't get that out of my mind. Sure, in The Sopranos, you know, maybe Silvio put on a sharkskin suit now and again, but she just got so defensive about it. The clothes, well, I just thought, you know, you're making such a big statement with these things. Let's talk about it. You know, they want to stand out. They want to be cool guys, I guess, or they want to be able to be spotted in a lineup. It doesn't seem like the best way to be covert. You know, there's a bunch of goofy violence in it. There's one scene that the screening that I was at, and there was quite a few people there, burst out laughing because they light a body on fire, trail of gas that goes all the way up to a body laying on the dock, and when the gas hits the body explodes. I don't know if someone's put an engine inside that body or a stick of dynamite.
Was it like a cop show, like an episode of McCloud or something in the early 70s?
But it wasn't a car that exploded, Jim. It was a body, a dead body. The only saving grace in this, and it's for a brief moment, is when Paul Gross shows up doing his sort of best Marlon Brando from The Island of Dr. Moreau, you know, with a ponytail on the top of his head and being all zen-like. Yeah, it was just, I just thought it was a giant mess. In fact, the Hollywood Reporter, I was thinking, maybe I'm just being a jerk. You know, that happens. And I looked up some other reviews, and the Hollywood Reporter reviewed it as a comedy. They thought it was a comedy.
Oh, boy.
And it's not supposed to be. So,
you and I talked about this the other day about that we don't have to mention names, but just that there are certain directors in our country that tend to get a little more juice than I think they deserve.
Right. Because we're too nice.
Coming out next week in regular release that is from a big Canadian director, and I just don't think this guy's done anything that's hit his mark since the early 2000s.
Right.
Yet the movies keep getting praised and keep getting people saying this is great, and I just don't get it.
It's this weird sort of reverence to the small auteur community. I don't know what it is either, because after seeing this and after having this really uncomfortable encounter while doing my job, and I tell you, I've done this job for well over 20 years. I've had lots of uncomfortable encounters and still be able to write about the product or whatever it was I was seeing, but this was just Yeah, it was a bit weird. And the movie is just, yeah. And I feel bad because the star in it is this guy named Randy Bahudo. He's a big star from India, and he's stunning. Look at it. And he does a pretty good job in this, even though, the whole film, he just has to scowl. So,
yeah. You and I said this, a month ago about The Visit and M. Night Shyamalan. Some directors just don't have more than one good film in them.
I think maybe some directors take themselves too seriously and don't...
If she's getting kind of petty and pissy about you asking a valid question about wardrobe choices, then I'm going to just say, okay, we're done.
Wait, that's it. That's kind of how it ended, actually, about 4 minutes later after a couple other moments of it. But like I said, after 20 years, that's not the first time that's happened. I mean, it doesn't happen often, but you just got to sometimes pull the pin on that one.
I agree. I've been in the business a long time like you. I certainly have had scraps with people I'm interviewing because they think I'm but we're arguing about the subject matter of this. If you're going to get like really petty over me asking a sincere question about why did you go aesthetically this way, visually this way. They got to answer that.
Why are your gangsters such idiots? Yeah. I know that when you join a gang, you got two choices: jail or death. You're usually not you're not the chem lab star from high school that goes into that. But these guys are such clowns; it's mind-boggling. All right. On that note, you're going off to cruise the Caribbean, I believe.
I am. Yes.
Okay. Well, don't eat too much, and please do not buy any bad art. You can't afford it.
Listen, I'm planning to do both.
Okay.
And you've just nailed down one thing that I'm getting you for Christmas.
Okay, that's it for this episode of the DGP with me, Dana G. Thanks a lot for listening. I'd like to thank a few people before we go today. Of course, thanking engineer Adam Foster. What would I do without you, Adam?
You're welcome.
Don't answer. Also, my guests, Chris Haddock and Elizabeth Hay. Check out his new TV show, The Romeo Section, and read her new book, His Whole Life. And, of course, the lovely and talented CTV film critic, Jim Gordon. Now, don't forget to download the show next week and check out my interview with Ty Ravine. Yes, that name might ring a bell. It's because it's probably in your subconscious. Get it? Anyways. Ty Ravine is the son of the late stage hypnotist and illusionist Ravine. It's that guy with the hair and is it called a Dick Van Dyke or just a Van Dyke?
Just beard? A Van Dyke.
Oh, that's Adam speaking. So we're going to be talking to him, and I'm going to be interested to talk to him because I have tried to be hypnotized in the past, and basically I just paid someone to go and nap. Because I'm not suggestible. I'm just not. You would never have me dancing as a chicken on a stage. But Adam, have you ever had any experience with such things?
I have, as a matter of fact. Ravine, I went to Ravine in Victoria years ago and went up on stage with all the other people and tried to have him hypnotize me, but oddly, it didn't work.
No, see, you're not suggestible either. You're stubborn like
me. Is that what it is, though?
Yeah, it is.
I always thought the other people that actually went along with it were just plants, but...
The other people usually that go along with it are suggestible, and because they want to fit in. Well, we can ask him all about it. I'm sure he's not going to give us his tricks of the trade.
Probably
not that I'm a know-it-all, but I do know a little bit about this topic, just through a friend who's a psychiatrist who told me all about it and used it. So, like I said, I just paid somebody like $150 an hour to nap. It's like nothing was straightened out. Nothing got fixed.
Sounds about right.
Nothing got fixed. Okay, so that's going to be on the episode next week. I think that one's going to be fun because that's something I've always wanted to talk to people like that. I don't know. It's just always interesting to talk to somebody who does something that makes a living. I don't know. We'll see. I promise to behave myself and not to be too cynical. No comment? Oh, my God. Anyways, Adam's not even listening now. Okay, so also on the show next week, it's time for another segment of What Are You Loving, Stephen Schelling? Now, Bon Vivant around town, Stephen Schelling, has this time out, he wants to talk about a certain 1980s cartoon that is making it to a live-action version on the big screen. He's quite crushed by this development, so we're going to check in with him. And, okay, so that's about it. So you can check us out at theprovince.com/podcasts or on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. And also follow The Province Podcast on Periscope. Thanks a lot for listening. And in the words of Ravine, keep it real.
You've been listening to the DGP, hosted by province writer Dana G. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana_G or read her stories on theprovince.com. Subscribe to this and other great province podcasts by searching iTunes or clicking the links available on theprovincepodcasts.com.